Good girl. You know, I've got something to fight for. We both have. Broke out Barnes with sudden deep feeling. Back home, these callow university pinks, these agitators, these damned communists who never heard of patriotism, say that Americans have no cause, nothing to fight for, no reason for loving country. Wait and see. By God, I'm going to carry things home to these murdering rats over here. This organization is now mine. I'm going to use it my own way, and everyone else be hanged.
Good for you,
came her voice, low, vibrant, rich.
You're not afraid to do things. Right or wrong, you do things. Most men don't anymore. They're afraid to make mistakes, afraid somebody will call them down. Ugh!
And let me tell you one thing, Barnes said, tapping her on the knee. Your report on that conversation in the hotel in Nice? Girl, that's big. It's going to change everything, all my plans. It shows me a lot. We'll not go into it now, for my brain's dead. By the way, take this photostat, won't you? Pin it under your dress and carry it. I'll feel safer.
All right, Mr. Sphinx,
she said, smiling, and the precious thing passed into her keeping. Mons grew ahead of them at last in mid-morning. 10 minutes after they arrived, Barnes was asleep. For the present, worries and cares were left behind. That same evening, after Barnes had dispatched a sheaf of telegrams, they visited a movie together in delicious relaxation and safety. A good night's sleep followed. With morning, they were off, driving unhurried through the rich Belgian fields. The wild and frenzied flight north was like an evil dream over and done with. Before reaching Ostend, they halted for dinner in order to delay their arrival until after dark. Marie Nicholas, getting a postcard, demanded a fountain pen.
Haven't one, said Barnes. She stared at him blankly.
But you have. What's that clipped to your waistcoat pocket?
Barnes grunted, drew out the pen to which she referred, and replaced it.
That, he said, is a little improvement of my own on a parlor toy. Waiter, de quoi écrire? Well, Marie, this time tomorrow night, either you or I should be hearing the Beethoven Mass and talking business with Grimaldi. I've instructed all my agents, by the way, that you're second in command.
Oh, but do you know you haven't explained that cipher?
Barnes whistled. Right. Later on, then. It'll take time. Get your postcard off and we'll be on our way.
Ostend, the glittering Atlantic city of the Belgian coast, opened before them. Ostend, the cheap and flashy, shop-worn with years and British trippers. Barnes, as usual, avoided the big hotels and drew to a halt before a small and unostentatious hostelry half a block from the boardwalk, as it would be termed in America.
"Behold the Belgian Lion," he exclaimed gaily. "Warranted a cheap, inconspicuous, and small inn. As soon as we get rooms, will you chase out and find me a stenographer?"
"I'm one," she said.
"I must have one who can put English or French into Italian, which I don't know."
"I speak Italian perfectly."
Barnes broke into a laugh. "Good. We'll dispense with the stenographer."
They secured rooms on the same floor. Half an hour later, Barnes finished his dictation. He took the photostat, which he had requested from Marie.
"Doesn't it seem rather silly to have only one of those?"
she asked.
"Precisely." And the gray eyes twinkled at her. "I'm going out now to find one of my men and have another made. Then we'll each have one. I've decided to let you conduct all negotiations with Grimaldi."
"What?"
Her gaze widened on him.
"But you?"
"We'll be throwing trucks in off the trail. The performance begins at 8 tomorrow evening. At 7, 2 tickets will be delivered here. The 2 seats next to Grimaldi, his wife, and secretary. You'll take them and go, presuming nothing happens to prevent you. If I don't show up, you'll have an empty seat beside you. Make an extra copy of that dictation and leave it for me if you don't see me in the morning at the hotel desk. Take your own copy with you. First is the contents of the photostat. Give that to Grimaldi and get his instant attention. Then give him the terms on which he may have the photostat, the second dictation. If he signs these, give him the photostat and the game's finished."
"But you..."
"What? Are you going around all your life repeating those two words?" demanded Barnes. "Me? I've got to see the American ambassador in the afternoon.
Let Truxen and possibly Rothstern follow me around and maybe buy me off. Who knows? I'll shove the photostat under your door if you're asleep when I get back.
I was trying to tell you, she retorted, that you can't have a copy made at night.
Barnes regarded her with lifted brows. You might tell me also, he rejoined, that it is impossible to get from the eye of a dead man the picture of his murderer. In both cases you would be wrong, quite contrary to general belief. I'll go into the matter scientifically with you the next time we find a murdered man and no clue to his killer. Meanwhile, my dear, enjoy yourself, keep off the streets, and don't talk with strange men. Au revoir. He departed with a grin, leaving her half angry, half perplexed. An hour later, after a long conversation with a lean, dark man whose curio shop window bore the startling name of Gismar de Hossian, Barnes went to one of the largest hotels in Ostend. No other, in fact, than the singularly named Hotel Delicious. Here he displayed himself prominently about the lobby, registered, secured a room, went to his room, and turned in for the night. She can handle Grimaldi better than I can anyhow, he reflected cheerfully, as he switched off his light. And I'm the bird they're all out to catch. So with luck and one stone, I'm liable to kill two birds and prove that the hand is quicker than the eye. Good hunting tomorrow, Rothstern. Damn your black heart.
When Marie Nicholas wakened the next morning, she found an envelope shoved under her door. In the envelope was the photostat. On the envelope was the rubber stamp of the Sphinx, USA. But she saw nothing of Barnes that day.
Chapter 5. A Strange, Sudden End. At 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon, Barnes was ushered into the presence of the American ambassador to France, who by some curious chance was also stopping at the Hotel Delicious. The diplomat looked worried, and he was worried.
"Barnes, this damned nonsense must stop," he exclaimed, in the undiplomatic language of big business. "Your wildcat organization is busted. These European crooks have got the whole crowd by the tail. Riley's dead, McGibbons is dead. Others are in jail. You must give up the whole show. It's come to an end."
"On the contrary," said Barnes coolly, "it's just begun. If you think two boys like Riley and McGibbons are going to be bumped off and nothing done about it, guess again. The crowd's busted, sure, just as I predicted it would be. I'm running the show with a crowd of my own now."
The other gave him a keen, angry glance.
"You're in earnest?"
"Absolutely and entirely, sir." The level glance of Barnes was like gray steel.
"You're a fool. These secret agents are dirty, double-crossing, treacherous rats. Men like you can't hope to fight 'em."
"Terriers wipe out rats," said Barnes. "Me, I'm the damnedest terrier you ever saw right now. This time tomorrow I can walk down the boulevards in Paris and the police will tip their hats to me instead of trying to grab me. Wait and see."
"You're a blasted ass. Europe is in a ticklish condition. None of us in the service can be responsible for you. If you get in a jam, you're without appeal. You've no connection with Washington. Damn it, I admire you with all my heart, but—"
"You stick in the embassy and I'll play the small-time circuit," and Barnes grinned. "What you don't know won't hurt you. With Marie Nicholas and a few of the old gang, I'm going ahead. You might tip off the other appointees from Washington to this effect. Now I'm in a bit of a rush. Do you want me to take that treaty draft over to the London embassy?"
"Yes, it's blasted important, too."
The ambassador extended a sealed envelope.
"Wrong. It'll die a borning," said Barnes. "I've learned something about it. This treaty is a blind to get Europe all head up over America's butting into the African game. Abyssinia would repudiate the treaty even if we bothered about it, which we won't."
And he departed, leaving the ambassador frowning after him, more worried than ever. Barnes left the hotel. He strolled over toward the plage, the wide expanse of sands, villas, bathing huts, stretching up to the massive concrete harbor works. He paused at a cafe, seated himself with a sigh, and ordered a Rossi. It was just 4 o'clock. He squirted the glass full of seltzer water, pinched the slice of lemon peel into the blood-red mixture, then sipped at it contentedly, and watched the passing throng. 10 minutes later, a large, beaming, jovial figure came swinging along, stopped short at sight of Barnes in well-simulated astonishment, then came to his table.
"My friend, Mr. Barnes, of all people!" exclaimed Rothstern cordially. "May I sit down?"
"Why not?" Barnes said. "Trailed me, have you? No use lying about it."
Rothstern chuckled as he seated himself and ordered a beer.
"I suppose not. We need not lie to each other, Hein."
He wiped his bald spot and beamed.
"Well, like you Americans, I shall get down to business. Come, Mr. Barnes, we need not be unfriendly. You are going to England? Would not a little English money come in useful over there?"
"A little? No," said Barnes curtly. "A whole lot might, though."
Rothstern heaved with laughter.
"Ah, you Americans! Come, my friend, I will make you an offer."
His voice dropped until it was barely audible.
£2,000 if you will let me copy the document you received from the American ambassador. No one will ever know. It will take 10 minutes.
"You think I'd sell out? To you?"
"Yes," said Rothstern blandly. "Remember, we have met before. You were ready enough to take my money then. Why not now? The cash is ready. We need only step over to my hotel. Why should we not remain friends, to the advantage of both?"
The gaze of Barnes lowered.
Maybe you're right, Rothstern. If what I hear is true, the game is up for most of us Americans anyhow."
"Ah, my boy, with Papa Rothstern, your friend, who knows? Come, finish your drink, step to the Grand Hotel with me, and in 15 minutes, poof, it is over."
Barnes kept his eyes veiled to hide their hot agitation. So plausible was the man that he might have been fooled had not Marie Nicholas overheard the actual intention of Rothstern, had he not known who was responsible for the deaths of Riley and McGibbons. Abruptly, he tossed down his drink.
"All right," he said with decision, "but I'll not walk over with you, naturally."
"Oh, as you like."
Rothstern rose.
"Come in 5 minutes. Take the elevator to the 4th floor. I'll be awaiting you in the corridor. So long."
He swung away with a wave of his malacca stick. Barnes looked after him, eyes narrowed, cold, implacable. 5 minutes later, Barnes rose, paid for the drinks, and walked toward the Grand Hotel. The die was cast now. He was gambling everything on one turn of the cards, almost literally. As he had told the ambassador, it was make or break this same night. He had no illusions whatever about Rothstern's intentions or the trap laid for him. The Grand Hotel, with its gardens and spacious lobby, opened before him. He walked steadily to the elevators, took a car up, and left it at the floor designated. Rothstern was waiting.
"Ah, you are wise, my friend, very wise. I welcome you," said the fat man with hearty cordiality. "Come along. I have everything ready. Here is the room."
And he flung open the door of a corner room with a laughing bow. Barnes, with a slight shrug, walked in. The door closed behind him. At one side stood Truxton, at the other the rat-like Stacy, each with a pistol in hand.
"Hello," exclaimed Barnes. "Why not a machine gun? I thought this was a private affair, Rothstern."
"An excess of zeal, perhaps, merely to make sure you are not armed, my friend,"
purred Rothstern.
"You do not object?"
"No, not in the least."
Barnes held up his arms. Truxton, he of the lean and savage features, stepped forward and frisked him, efficiently.
"So that is finished," exclaimed Rothstern. "Now we shall all be friends, Stacy. Go and get the motor car ready for us. Mr. Truxton, you will remain, if Mr. Barnes has no objection?"
"I have," said Barnes coolly. "Our talk is to be private."
"Very well."
Rothstern turned and winked significantly at Truxton.
"Go into the adjoining room and wait. But leave the door open, mind. Come, Mr. Barnes, we can settle matters comfortably at the table."
Stacy departed with an air of disappointment. Truxton, scowling savagely, went into the next room of the suite. Rothstern showed his victim to a chair at the center table, himself taking a seat opposite.
"Now,"
he said, rubbing his hands,
First, the treaty draft. Here, I have paper ready.
And the money? Asked Barnes in a cold voice.
Ah, yes, the money, of course.
Rothstern reached into his pocket and brought forth an envelope which he handed over. His gaze was greedy, excited, nervous.
Barnes produced the sealed envelope which the ambassador had given him, and Rothstern snatched at it, broke the seals, drew out the folded paper.
Ah, this is it?
Of course, said Barnes. You want to copy it? Here's a pen.
He took the fountain pen from his pocket, then froze abruptly. Rothstern's hand jumped forward, covering him with a pistol. The fat, jovial features were suddenly cruel, tense, deadly.
Hands there on the table. That's right, cried Rothstern. All right, Truxton.
The latter appeared, giving Barnes a quick, cold grin.
So, my very good friend, snarled Rothstern viciously. You think to play with me, eh? You think to take my money and go? Not so quickly, young man. You have a lot to learn. You have other things I want to see. What about your meeting with the Italian ambassador Grimaldi? Yes, I know about that. You're helpless. You're in my hands now. I have the treaty entrusted to you. Be careful, or I can ruin you.
Rothstern, you're a good actor, said Barnes coolly. Trying to work me, are you? Trying to force me to cough up all I know? And then you'll kill me. Oh, don't deny it. What about your instructions to Truxton and Stacy, that night you met them in the hotel at Nice?
Rothstern started. His eyes distended a trifle.
Ah? God, how do you know that?
He muttered thickly.
Never mind. No time to discuss it, Barnes rejoined. I've only time to remind you of something, Rothstern. You're a damned murderer. You were behind the death of Riley, of McGibbons, just as you expected to be behind my death.
Well?
The gaze of Rothstern bored into him, no longer jovial but wicked and cold with hatred.
What of it?
Barnes shrugged and looked down.
I'm just reminding you, that's all. Suppose you go ahead and copy the paper.
And casually, he unscrewed the top of the fountain pen and laid it down. Then he leaned back in his chair, produced a cigarette, and lit it, with an air of perfect unconcern.
Rothstern stared at him for a moment, as though trying to figure out his attitude. Then, putting the pistol on the table at one side, Rothstern emitted a grunt.
You damned American swine, he said slowly. Ah, if I could only have my way, all of you would go.
He swallowed hard, opened and shut his mouth spasmodically, then fell back in his chair. A little sigh escaped him, and his chin sank on his breast.
Good God, cried out Truxton. A stroke.
With the word, Truxton darted forward, caught at the pistol, shoved it into his pocket, then leaned over the crumpled figure of Rothstern. He glanced up suddenly at Barnes, who had not moved. What he read in the face of Barnes brought him erect.
You, he cried out. You devil!
His hand went to his pocket. Like a flash, Barnes was out of his chair, flinging himself forward. Too late. Truxton had no idea whatever of using a pistol here in the hotel. A supple persuader leaped out in his hand. As Barnes came into him, he struck once, and with the swiftness of light. Barnes went down like a shot and lay on the floor beneath the table, face to the carpet, senseless. With a scornful oath, Truxton straightened up, then once more leaned over and caught Rothstern by the shoulder and shook him. He looked down and saw the paper in the hand of Rothstern. His eyes dilated upon it. There upon the paper was a scarlet rubber stamp, the figure of a sphinx.
So that was it, muttered Truxton. That was what?
He caught his breath suddenly, turned, started for the door, but he did not reach it. Barnes came to himself presently. His eyes opened as he lay there with his face against the carpet. For a moment he lay quiet. His gaze swept the floor. He saw the feet of the dead Rothstern, and over near the door he saw Truxton outstretched, both hands gripping at the carpet. Then, without rising, Barnes drew himself away from the table little by little.
There was a trickle of blood on his cheek, and his head was swollen. Truxton had not spared strength in that blow. Presently Barnes gathered himself, came to one knee, and rose. He went to the nearest window and opened it, not without difficulty, for his head was swimming. He turned and looked at the room again.
"So, he knocked me over and put me in the safest place of all," he murmured,
and a thin, hard smile touched his lips for an instant and was gone. He took from his pocket the envelope of Bank of England notes Rothstern had given him and made a gesture of repugnance. He crossed to where Truxton lay and felt the man's limp, dead hand. He took the notes from the envelope and pressed the dead fingers hard about them. He kept the envelope, which bore his finger marks. Then he came back to the table, reached out gingerly, and took up his fountain pen. He screwed the cap in place and pocketed the thing.
"Executions by gas," he observed, his voice striking low and sharp upon the terrible silence of the room, "are still a novelty in Europe." "There's your warning, Europe," he said grimly. "Tell 'em all your story, Rothstern. Chancelleries, police, detectives, secret agents, cabinet members. Tell the whole blasted crowd your story. They'll understand right enough."